Welcome to the Deep Dive, where we dig into complex research and find the knowledge that really matters. Today, we are tunneling into solid-state diffusion. Now, on the surface, that might sound, you know, as simple as two different piles of atoms slowly mixing together, but what we're diving into is proof that it is anything but simple.
That's absolutely right. For nearly a century, scientists, physicists, they all believed that when two solids diffuse, the interface between them either stays put or it just shifts to a single new spot. Our deep dive today shows that this established idea is, well, it's wrong. We're going to show you how a single boundary can split into two or even three stable interfaces inside the material.
And the core evidence that started this whole mess that proved this was a complex business came from the Kirkendall effect. So let's start there. For anyone who might be catching up, what exactly is the Kirkendall effect and why is it so foundational?
The Kirkendall effect is the most explicit physical proof we have that atoms and solids don't just trade places directly. Instead, they move by hopping into empty spots in the lattice, what we call vacancies. The whole mechanism is vacancy mediated.
So we're really talking about tiny atomic voids moving around, which lets the atoms themselves move.
Precisely. To prove it, you set up what's called a diffusion couple. Two materials, let's say A and B, pressed firmly together. And to see what's happening, you put these tiny inert markers, historically things like fine tungsten wires or sometimes even microscopic ceramic spheres, right at that initial boundary.
The markers are the neutral third party. They're the witnesses at the crime scene.
Exactly. So you heat this whole thing up. If material A's atoms move faster across that boundary than material B's atoms, we call that unequal intrinsic diffusivities, then you get this unequal flow. And that unequal flow causes the entire crystal lattice in that zone to physically shift. The markers, which are just sitting there, get carried along. When you look later, they've moved. That motion is the Kirkendall effect.
That seems simple enough, but that unequal atomic traffic has a massive consequence, right?
I mean, if one type of atom is flooding a zone faster than the other, what happens?
Well, think about it. If you have a huge net flow of A atoms going left, you must have a huge net flow of vacancies going right to balance it out. And if the material can't collapse on itself fast enough to get rid of those vacancies, they start to coalesce.
They form voids. They become pores.
Yes. And this is a really destructive consequence. We see it in systems like cobalt silicon. Cobalt diffuses way faster into silicon, and you get these huge pores forming in the reaction layer. They're structurally dangerous. And that area, that's what we call the Kirkendall plane.
And for decades, the scientific community just assumed there was one of these planes, one predictable line where the markers would end up and one place where those voids would form. But the sources you found show that even early on, researchers kept running into strange behavior that just didn't fit that neat picture. And that's where the story gets really interesting. These early observations, you just couldn't ignore them. Researchers would check their markers and four. They weren't in a single neat line. For instance, a researcher named Carter, he was studying ceramic oxides, and he found his molybdenum wire markers had actually split into distinct sections embedded in different places in the material.
And a similar thing happened with Bastin and Reek, didn't it? With a tungsten wire in a titanium nickel couple.
Correct. The marker wire split and was found in two completely different phases that formed during the diffusion. These historical anomalies were a huge hint that the idea of a single, unique Kirkendall plane was just fundamentally flawed.
So the central leap here is that this plane isn't singular. It can bifurcate, split into two, or as we'll get to, even trifurcate into three. To predict this, you need a really powerful tool. And this brings us to the Kirkendall velocity curve construction.
This model is what finally let people make sense of those messy old observations. Instead of guessing, the model lets you calculate the velocity of the markers at every single point across the diffusion zone.
Okay, so how should we think about this? I want to avoid just, you know, throwing math at everyone. What are we actually plotting here?
Good point. You're graphing the local speed of the lattice, which is really just a function of the difference in how fast the atoms are moving against its position. And the key is finding the exact spot where that calculated local speed matches the overall speed of the growing layer at that point.
So we're looking for an intersection, a match, where the local atomic traffic speed equals the movement of the entire neighborhood.
Exactly. And each point where that speed curve intersects the overall growth rate line, that gives you a potential Kirkendall plane. But here's the critical nuance, stability.
Here's where it gets really interesting. How does the shape of that curve tell you if the plane is going to be neat and tidy or just a mess?
It's all about the gradient, the slope of the curve at that intersection. If the curve is sloping down Or negatively, it acts like a valley. It's a focusing point. Any markers that wander a bit get pulled back.
And that gives you a nice, tight, well-defined plane.
A stable plane, yes.
And if it slopes positively, like the peak of a hill.
That's an unstable Kirkendall plane. A marker that wanders is pushed away, not pulled back. In the real world, this means the markers don't settle into a line. They just scatter, forming a wide dispersed array.
Which people had actually seen, right, in systems like Goldzinc.
They had. The theory predicted both outcomes perfectly.
That is just a profound shift. The math doesn't just locate the boundary, it predicts its physical nature. So to prove this idea of multiplicity, researchers needed a really clean system. They turned to this intermetallic myol. Why was that material so ideal?
Myol, or nickel aluminum, is perfect because its defect structure is incredibly sensitive to its composition. If it's a little nigh-rich, it handles the imbalance with what we call anti-side defects. Nickel atoms sit where aluminum atoms should be.
So they're just swapping places, structurally.
Right. But if you flip to the Ulrich side, the whole mechanism changes. Now, the material uses structural vacancies to accommodate the extra aluminum. Specifically, empty spots on the nickel sublattice.
So you have two completely different ways atoms are moving, depending on which side of the ideal composition you're on.
Precisely. And that structural difference means that the difference in their diffusivities, how fast Ni moves versus how fast Al moves, it has to change signs somewhere near the middle. It flips from positive to negative.
And when that difference flips, the Kirkendall velocity curve is forced to cross the zero line, creating multiple potential intersections.
That's the key. And the experiment confirmed it beautifully. The markers, originally at one interface, settled into two distinct, well-defined Kirkendall planes. They call them K1 and K2. Bifurcation, confirmed. In a single phase.
Wow. And this doesn't just happen in single phases. It also happens in more complex, multi-layered systems. You mentioned the silver-zinc couple.
Yes. The zinc-silver couple is a great example. It forms three distinct product layers. Trying to guess where one initial interface ends up across three new materials sounds like chaos.
So where did the markers end up?
The velocity curve predicted two stable intersections, and that's exactly what they found. Two stable Kirkendall planes. One was inside the epsilon phase layer, and the other was inside the gamma phase layer. Bifurcation, but this time across two different materials.
This just begs the next question. If it can split into two, can it go further? The research points to a record holder trifurcation.
Yes, the ultimate split. This was seen in the titanium aluminum system. It's notorious for forming a whole zoo of different intermetallic phases.
And when they let this thing diffuse, where did the markers go?
Not one, not two, but three different phases. They found a plane in the TL2 layer, another in the TL layer, and a third in the Ti3L layer. Three stable Kirkendall planes from one starting interface.
That is immense complexity. And the fact that this baffling result could be predicted by the velocity curve model is just a huge testament to the power of that theory.
Absolutely. It takes it from being a weird anomaly to a predictable consequence of the physics.
So beyond just the location, does a Kirkendall plane leave any sort of visual clues in the microstructure? Is it something you could spot under a microscope?
Often, yes. A stable Kirkendall plane tends to be marked by a clear change in the grain morphology on either side of it.
What causes that difference in the grain structure?
It's directly tied to the growth kinetics. In a system like titanium aluminum, the grains have different shapes and orientations across those marker planes because the diffusion rate itself depends on the crystal orientation of the grains.
So the movement of the plane is tied to the crystal structure, and where it settles, you see a change in how the new crystals are forming.
Exactly. The growth and the marker movement are completely inseparable.
This all seems incredibly technical, but it's critically important for real-world engineering, isn't it? Specifically for the electronics industry.
It is absolutely vital. Every modern miniaturized device you own relies on solid-state interconnects. Solder joints. Mm-hmm. Think copper tin or gold tin systems. If those joints fail, your device is a brick.
And the Kirkendall plane is basically the weak link in that chain.
It is the notoriously problematic feature. Because that plane is where the extra vacancies pile up, it becomes a void zone. And voids mean high mechanical stress and a huge risk of failure.
Let's talk about that copper tin example. It's everywhere. How did this play out there?
So in a standard copper-tin couple, they found one stable Kirkendall plane inside the Q6-SN5 phase. Predictable. Manageable. But commercial systems often use tiny additives. When researchers added just 1 atomic percent of nickel to the copper, the whole process changed.
Did the plane move?
Not really. Which means the diffusion ratio was similar. But the amount of porosity, the number of voids forming at that plane, it increased drastically. The nickel changed how the vacancies were handled, making that one plane significantly more destructive.
So the fact that the plane can be multiple fundamentally changes the engineering challenge. It's not just managing one risk zone anymore.
Exactly. For years, engineers focused on that single assumed plane. Now they have to face the risk that diffusion porosity, the prime cause of failure, could develop at two or even three distinct locations inside a tiny interconnect. It completely changes the reliability calculation.
So we've gone from this simple idea of a shifting interface all the way to the complex reality of bifurcation and trifurcation, all predictable with this model. The discovery that one initial boundary can split into three distinct zones of weakness is? It's just a powerful testament to the complexity hidden in materials.
It is, and it also leaves us with a fascinating challenge for the future. We mentioned that diffusion rates are affected by grain boundaries and crystal orientation. So if we know exactly where these volatile Kirkendall planes are predicted to form, what if engineers could design alloys or control the fabrication to create substrates with specific grain orientations? The goal would be to deliberately slow down diffusion in those predicted failure zones, minimizing or even preventing these weak planes from forming in the first place. That's really the next frontier.